Welcome to the Level Design Podcast with Scott Zern, professional engineer with over three decades of experience and founder of Level Design Partners, a for-benefit company striving to bring prosperity to the design professional. Check out what they're up to at leveldesignpartners.com. This podcast will be exploring the ins and outs of the design industry, bringing new thinking to outdated systems, and aiming to restore value and honor to the unique people who choose to be designers, engineers, and architects. We'll be discussing how you can thrive in this industry by creating more freedom, flexibility, and financial security as a design professional, regardless of your current situation.
Murray McBride, good morning.
Morning, Scott.
How are you? I'm good. I'm doing all kinds of structure stuff with the company, but I'm good.
Doing the same thing. Designing things,
fixing things.
Designing houses to stand up.
Houses.
No, it's a great time. We're busy, and enjoying it.
How's your last few weeks? It's been a few weeks since we did this.
It has. It's been busy is the right word. Have a lot of...
Are you working too hard here, or what's going on?
I don't know about working too hard. I mean, I think I could work more efficiently. We had that discussion a while back at one of our team meetings about the ICQ program. In other words, our integrity, our customer service, and our work quality.
Yeah. The balance.
Yeah. I'm really good at a couple, but I'm not so good at one of them. We won't get into details. That's the beauty of Level and Level Design Partners, as it gets off the ground, is the ability to look at that, to vet it with your partners, your other members, and to maintain that balance.
Yeah.
And I've actually seen that quite a bit lately in terms of dealing with clients. We always try and keep our clients, you know, satisfied, happy, you know, with what we're doing. But
how come? I mean, what's different?
I think because we're getting busier and busier when we've got new people coming on board.
I think it's because there's no corporate between you and the client.
Oh, absolutely.
That's what I think.
Yeah, and everyone has that expectation that, well, this, as you say, that corporate barrier they have to get around or over. We don't have
or
that.
Or protect you from your behavior, right? You know, you could behave poorly in an organization. And
yeah, we don't need that.
Not be accountable, yeah.
Because that protection costs money. And it consumes money that we, as a member of Level Engineering or a Level Engineer or as an LDPI member, we've taken that away and got rid of that. And we can be responsible, accountable ourselves as how we manage our clients.
And our clients also have a reciprocal 360 access to their designer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if they're not pleased with you, they can yell at you and that's okay. But we try and meet their needs through, you know, good engineering, common sense behavior, and most importantly, good communication.
Yep.
Just had a meeting the other day with one of our Level engineers. Actually, it was Steve and Ashley, and I were on a conference call, and he made a wonderful point to a new client, actually a very important client,
uh-huh.
A commercial client. The one thing that we want to do as a Level engineer is we want to make sure that our communication is top notch.
Yeah.
That we're there with you and you understand where we're going, what we do, and the needs that we might have from you as a client and how we can best serve you. And it was a wonderful part of the meeting.
Yeah.
And I have to.
Fun week. I mean, today we have our engineer from New York City helping with a modeler, our engineer out of Las Vegas, and helping our Utah engineer with a large project in Salt Lake City. And we're all on the conference call and the team's actually from all over the country bringing in different assets. It's a fun to watch. So
I'm glad you mentioned that, Scott. That's part of how we're growing.
Yeah.
The attraction of coming on board with this business, with this model, and the freedom of being able to design, to be able to be a business person,
everybody's
an entrepreneur, and everyone just
embraces fun.
Yeah, it embraces it. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun to go to work.
Yep.
If it's down the hall or 100 miles away, it's fun to go to work.
Or in your house.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Down
you
the
work
hall.
From home. Yeah.
Yeah. You put your slippers on and get in.
No, all right. Murray, we have a guest today.
We do.
Mr. Ben Canny. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome, Ben. I just got to meet you this morning. Great to have you on board and talk about some important things.
It's good to be here.
Ben's president and owner of Engineering Ops. I always get it backwards. I always call it Operations Engineers. Which one is it?
Engineering Operations.
Engineering Ops, yeah.
EO.
EO. Yep. Tell me about EO and Ben. Tell the audience. I already know, I think. But
yeah. Well, engineering operations, we specialize in bridge inspection, rating, design. We do a lot of specialty type bridge work. And our clients are DOTs. We do some small...
What's a DOT for the audience?
Department of Transportation.
State Departments of Transportation. Yeah.
And we do some municipality work, work for counties, but it's typically DOT work. And they're federal, comes from federal funds, and the audience is tax dollars. So...
Yeah, the audience is taxed out. Yeah.
Well, and that is a really good point, Ben. I'm so glad to have you here and that you mentioned that. Scott and I have touched on that as we've discussed around infrastructure. Our biggest asset as a citizen is the infrastructure that surrounds our homes, surrounds what we drive on and at. And Ben is just an example of someone who actually helps, in this case, DOTs, or we local might do it with a municipality, help. Basically take that money and allocate it to things that the needs of either maintaining or building new infrastructure and how you go about doing that. And it's a collaborative way of doing things because
why do we care about bridges so much? So these bridges have been around for thousands of years. I mean, the aqueducts, these things that are over waterways, and why is it treated differently than, I don't know,
something underground?
A light post.
Yeah.
Why is a bridge, why do we care about bridges?
Well, bridges have so this much. Aesthetic attraction. They're sexy.
Aesthetic?
No, they do.
Oh, yeah. As I drive by 100 miles an hour, I go, that's a badass bridge.
The other thing, it has a definite purpose. It gets you across the river. It gets you there. And
all right.
I like, from an engineering standpoint, a structural standpoint, I look at a bridge and think, how does it stand up? Now, someone driving across it is going to an accountant, going to a meeting, things, thank God the bridge is here because it can get from A to B really quickly across the river.
Oh, they are not thinking that. They don't even notice it anymore.
Well, they may not, which you don't. And if you drive on one bridge and look down...
If anything we accomplish this podcast, let's get on the other side of that bridge is important to the public. Let's let the accountant know that, oh yeah, this is important, actually, well, for me to get to my meeting.
His tax dollars take care of it.
God, if we can accomplish that today, that would be awesome.
Well, bridges are important, but we're starting to realize, we're kind of at a point in our society and culture where we're realizing that managing and how we manage our assets is what's important. So bridges are one of those assets, and they do carry the public, so they get a higher risk factor, right? So you've got bridges, you've got, like you said, you've got light poles, you've got ancillary structures, signs. I mean, a sign could blow over at a hurricane in Florida and hurt people on the road. So there's a risk factor there. So that's how we start prioritizing the assets. We look at the risk involved with human life, and we assign them a category, and we inspect them based on those categories.
Thank you, Ben. You sort of...
Well, it's so true, right? If we do lose a bridge, Arkansas, perfect example, how long is the detour route? And it's through a bunch of little communities. The impacts are huge, right?
Yeah. Everyone has to take another half hour. A trucking company has to spend more money getting produce.
Poor communities that are just dealing with this traffic at this point.
Yeah. Well, and I haven't seen the report for that bridge, but every inspection report includes a detour route on there. So it's part of the inspection to say, hey, if this bridge is closed, you know, there's a detour route that is 11.2 miles. It's probably a little bit more than that for the I-40, but...
So it's not just a report on that bridge. It's a more of a global
understanding of
how, if that bridge, you have to shut it down for some reason based on your inspection.
Yeah.
You know where they're going to go and what the impacts are going to be.
Oh, yeah. There's geometries involved, you know, year, age, type of steel. I mean, if you need to do repairs, there's a lot that goes into an inspection report. And a lot of those are carryover notes. You know, the steel type's not going to change. The geometry is not going to change. So it's not like you're redoing that every time, but it's reviewed and agreed within each inspection.
Ben, is there an importance factor based on this information?
So when you say importance factor.
All right. Well, this bridge goes down, you know, or.
No.
Okay. It's just information.
Yeah. It's just information. Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, of course, the jurisdiction's reviewing that and go, okay, this is pretty important to us, but.
And that's where we're going with asset management. We're trying to figure out, like, a risk-based, what level, you know, how important is it on a whatever scale that their program comes up with to help assign you know, dollars. How do we allocate funding? We've got 10 things to fix. Which one do we fix? And that I think is the hardest thing for DOTs and municipalities, is determining where the money should be spent each year.
Yeah. Once you have a listing of, say, bridges under repair program for a particular year, does your firm collaborate with other consultants in terms of the impacts of transportation or other emergency services, all the things that go into detouring around the bridge because you have to repair it, so the traveling public has opportunities to make decisions on alternative routes and that. Do you get into that at all? Or
I mean, we don't get into that. That's usually done in after the inspection. The inspection is done, kind of provides the facts of what's wrong.
Okay.
And then they'll put it out to a design or to a repair. And if they decide that bridge is going to be fixed, then that kind of goes to the
next
phase.
Done. Yeah, that falls into my previous positions as your leaders, your public works leaders, your directors, local or your state chief engineers, state engineers. They take this information and they look at their budgets. They prioritize importance. So that's actually another staffer, a leader in that organization, be a state DOT or a local, deciding what to do when we get these reports. You're like, okay, this is a surprise. Or Ben, you can maybe describe this to the audience. Is actually this, you know, we had this bridge inspection 5 years ago. This thing's really, the ratings and its ratings are really going down pretty fast. Something's up with this bridge. Let's start programming it for funding. And then there's a lot of funding opportunities based on the ratings. So 80% of our bridges are actually fall in local jurisdictions. They're not in state systems. They're actually in local.
Yes.
And so the locals are struggling with, a lot of states go, okay, well, we have this fund for locals on their bridges when their ratings fall below a certain point. They have eligibility for funds from the state.
So in many ways, there's a lot more competition for local monies, whether it goes to bridges or other roadway projects.
It's ridiculous. Well, at a state
and they're pulling at the same bag of money as opposed to, say, the federal government, which has interstate bridges or more major infrastructure, but has less of those, I think as you pointed out, Ben, the ancillary items that get in the way of, say, funding your local stuff don't affect the federal monies.
I have spent many, many meetings in different municipalities where the locals don't fund bridges at all, and they're really relying on the inspection reports that Ben's company's producing and just trying to capture state money, which is
really a problem. In the waiting game for money, hoping that the bridge is going to be okay.
They don't even do that. They just say, I'm just going to rely on the state funding, and they don't do maintenance. That's the problem. We just let things get
bad. And that we're trying to change that. So we're getting into, for example, a lot of bridges recently have fallen from good to fair, right?
Mm-hmm.
And once they fall to that fair category, you know, it starts deteriorating a lot quicker.
Yes.
So if you can do preventative maintenance in Colorado, for example, joints are huge. If you can replace the joints and keep water away from the bearings and those beam ends, you can really extend the life of a bridge.
Okay. It's not the superstructure. It's those connections.
It's the connections, okay, that the areas that are susceptible to, you know, here we have mag chloride.
Yeah.
We have a lot of things that help deteriorate a bridge a lot quicker.
Yeah.
So you protect those key areas and you can really stretch out the lifespan of a bridge.
Yeah, just for the audience, the mag chloride that Ben's talking about is a magnesium chloride that's sprayed on the roads in lieu of a salt sand mixture, and that is very corrosive to metals, and it's very corrosive to utility lines and that. And they've had cases, I think, where power poles have almost gone on fire because of the buildup of
mag chloride
up to the utility lines. It can be quite detrimental.
Yeah.
And no, it's not unlike our drainage issues for homes and commercial buildings and that, where you keep water away from the structure.
Do you guys have any Ben might, but I just looked this up. That's the only reason. How many bridges are in this country?
I won't even try and guess. Now, Ben,
In this country. How many bridges? Help the audience out. What's the definition of a bridge?
So a major structure would be a bridge 20 feet or more in length. So if it spans 20 feet or more, it's considered a bridge. If it's less than that, it's a minor structure.
Minor culvert or whatever it might be.
Yeah. So in that category, spans over 20 feet, we've got over 600,000 structures.
Whoa. Okay.
So under 20, we probably got 1 million or 1.5 million.
Yeah. At least. It could be 3-4 times that amount.
Carrying vehicles. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking, you know, pipe culverts, but actual spanning beams were probably over 2 million.
Yeah. So a lot of those are on public roads, or on public right-of-way, county roads, or
80% of them are.
There was a very sad case a few years back on a fire, a grass fire. I think it was more out east of the metro area, down south and east of the Denver metro area, where a bridge burned out, and there was some first responders killed because the darn fire engine dropped into where the bridge was. You just don't expect that to happen, but it does. That's a rarity, but
yeah. Well, we talk about this on this podcast, but we were talking, what was the last one? Was it 10% of all the carbon emissions in the world are from just producing concrete?
Yeah, which is the primary ingredient for bridges, concrete and steel.
Concrete, yeah. That's 10% of our pollution. If we keep tearing down, wait till bridges, to Ben's point, if we keep waiting for bridges to fail and that's when we work on them,
yeah.
Well, what are you doing? You're making more concrete.
Making more concrete, you have a major impact on your environment. And the other thing we talked about is the potential energy of structures that lie there as a result of them being built, whether it's 100 years ago or 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That energy has been expended to build that structure, so it's in the best interest of your financing, your community, your environment, to go ahead and maintain that structure.
Every 80 people own a bridge.
Yeah.
In this society.
Yeah.
Crazy. That's just bridges, yeah. By the way.
That's a great example, Scott. Think of your investment of your tax dollars. Where is it going? It's going into your transportation. It's going into your water, wastewater net. Look at it and sort of understand that. This is what we're wanting to give out to our audience. Understand where this is going. Yeah. So Ben and his work and can sort of think, okay, this is why we have to do this. This is why we have to maintain it. This is why we want to push our dollars towards looking after our infrastructure.
Ben, how many are in this fair category versus bad category, and how many of them could be maintained and extended fairly affordably?
Well, a lot of the bridges in our country are in poor condition. And I think once they get to that, we're at a level where we have to rehabilitate them or replace them.
What's a poor condition in this generally? And there's a lot of different ways, but just...
Well, poor by the federal definition, bridges are ranked on a 1-9 scale. 7, 8, and 9 are good to very good, and 5 and 6 are fair, and then 4 and less are poor. So it depends on the engineer out there inspecting, you know, what they're looking at that kind of ranks them in those categories. In the early 2000s, we switched over to element level inspection, which kind of looks at each element of the bridge. And the idea with that was to be able to, you know, start maintaining them, you know, preventative maintenance, look at each element, the joints, for example. It's not a structural member at all, but if we're ranking that joint and we know that it's, you know, 50% failed, it lets the maintenance crews know, hey, let's go out there and put a joint on it. Whereas before, we never looked at that. We just let it fall apart and it would be years before. So that was the idea, is to start catching these things sooner that are affecting the structural components of the bridge. But to your question, you know, I can speak to Colorado. I know we've had a lot of them that have moved into the fair category recently that had always been good before. Thinking about how easy it is to drop a bridge from a 7 to a 6,
right.
You know, that's not a huge thing, but it does let you know that we need to start putting some money into preventative maintenance.
The system.
Yeah.
Maintenance.
Yeah.
You're saying quite a few have moved from the 7 category, which is the lower end of the good scale, into a fair category. What's the general sort of response in terms of the DOT and how they're going to sort of start addressing it? Do you see that as saying, okay, wait a minute, we've got a problem here?
Not so much there. I mean, the DOT wants to know what it really is. You know, they need to know. Our job as inspectors is to say, this is what the bridge is. This is the category it fits in, so that they can prioritize their bridges. So that's our job. I think that sometimes there's not enough attention drawn to when a bridge does change categories. The maintenance recommendations should change when a category changes. If it's changing from a 7 to a 6, there should be some new maintenance recommendations that are going with that, that are going to prolong the life of it.
Mm-hmm. It has to be a living file.
Yeah,
Don't just close the file drawer and think, oh, God, that's a 6 now, and that goes over to that file because it's fear.
Exactly.
Keep it moving.
And that mentality is changing. Like, people are becoming more aware of that. It used to just be inspection, and now there's, you know, master plan contracts and preventative maintenance contracts. And there's a lot of genuine interest to try to get ideas about how we can be effective.
You bring up a very important word, aware. The DOTs have to maintain that awareness of what's going on.
Yeah.
And if you do that, there's going to be someone in the group that's going to embrace that more than others, because they see the bigger picture. And if you do that, you keep it alive. You keep that thing moving.
Well, Murray, I'm going to keep bringing this up in this podcast, is the staffs of these organizations are actually quite amazing staffs. This thing about government employees or whatever, it's really, really not what's going on. These staffs and these public works or these state departments are just extraordinary, hardworking people with a lot of care. That's why they're there, because they care about their community. They're just, it's not them. They're very, very passionate about maintaining these systems on behalf of the public. They're very driven people, maybe the most driven people I've ever met.
Yeah.
And they don't get time off.
They do not get time.
Yeah. A bridge gets hit on a Saturday, there's a response.
Don't take me wrong. I'm not placing judgment on people.
No, not you, but this is just a fascinating topic for me. Where this all falls down is these wonderful, great human beings caring about infrastructure, getting data from the field, understanding their issues, prioritizing. They're doing a wonderful job. Where we just can't make it happen is asking for the funding from our public. This is where this falls down. We just can't seem to, that this podcast, I hope, at least gets people thinking about for the future generations is, hey, you can't ignore this. You know, when a proposition or tax increase about the highways comes forward, think about it when you vote.
Yeah.
Because like Ben said, if we can maintain it, we can extend its life.
It's cheaper.
If
we can maintain it, it's cheaper.
Yeah.
And we just got to do it the whole way. Just keep doing it. It's either a little bit all the time, or we have to put a ton in at the end when things are failing. And to be frank, we can't afford that.
We can't afford it.
So we have to.
So
we have to change.
We have to change our behavior, right?
Yeah.
Either the DOTs or the public works director somehow have to deliver the message, or our audience needs to be more receptive, or maybe both. Mm. But I 100% agree with you. We can't do this for lots of reasons.
Because then you get to the situation where a bridge is shut down. You can't do anything until it gets fixed.
Or the environment. We can't keep making concrete. Or our pocketbook. We can't afford it.
No, thank you.
Right.
And the one thing that's what limits everything is it comes down to money at the end of the day. And you only have a certain amount to make decisions.
Yeah.
So if you can spread it out, you can fix a lot more bridges at that level. So
it feels like bridges in general, that money can also shift to other infrastructure, transportation elements.
Does it feel like entitlement? Our population's got into the infrastructure as an entitlement.
Well,
they're entitled to it. They don't have to pay for it.
You brought out the word message. We're trying to do this through our, and I think we're going to be successful through the podcast, is to give people something to think about. We're not here to force anyone to do this or do that. We just want people to have some input as to how we as engineers go about doing our job to maintain infrastructure, to maintain our society.
The infrastructure bill.
Yeah.
That's getting pushed forward, making a lot of noise, right?
It is making a lot of noise. And we talked about a little bit about, is that being vetted and
it is. I actually did some research. Yeah, it's in the committees right now. Yeah, there's a lot of work going on.
That's wonderful. Because that has to go, I use the analogy, don't polish the shiny bridge, go fix the ones that, Ben, you're working with that really need some attention.
Need help.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, and back to your question, I don't think it's entitlement. I just think it's awareness. Like, I don't think people know what it costs. You drive over a bridge and you don't understand how much money goes into that. you know, it's.
I'm going to hang on to that idea that's what's going on. I love that. If that's what's going on, I love that because that's what this podcast can help and other information. But if we can do that part, Ben, that would be great. How much does a bridge cost these days?
A small bridge is several million dollars.
Yeah. Used to be $125 a square foot way back in the 80s when I was designing bridges with a consulting firm. And it's probably, what, 500 a square foot now?
Probably, at least. I mean, it depends on the bridge.
Yeah.
And all that goes into, so they weigh design, bridge type, replacement, demo, all that is part of the bridge cost.
And we've got brilliant engineers and contractors and, as you pointed out, Scott, the people in the DOTs, the people in the public engineering and works business, whether they're an engineer or an accountant, that have this desire to build these things as best and efficiently as possible.
Yeah.
And so as a driver, as you go across the bridge, every square, or walk across the sidewalk of the bridge, every square foot you see is $500 plus. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's 600,000, 1.5 million of them out there. So.
Yeah.
Okay, we had some kind of a breakdown on Arkansas Bridge. We have, is it financial? Is it human? Is it some kind of breakdown in the system?
Tell us, Ben.
What is it? Structure? It might be the structure of how we, it could be just the structure of tasks. You know, you have an entity, maybe an employee versus an entity contracts with a consulting firm. Maybe it's just the structure that caused part of this.
Well, there's another thing too. A steel beam doesn't ask you whether it's going to crack or not. If the loading is such on a steel beam, whether it's metallurgy or whatever it might be, it cracks because it happened to be loaded to a point that it failed. Failed at that point.
Yeah. Well, and I think just to rewind, you said a breakdown of the bridge. So the bridge has a failure of a key member. The bridge is a fracture critical bridge. So what that means is that the member is steel and its intention to where one of these members that fails would, the whole bridge would fall down. Whoa. That's what a fracture critical inspection or bridge is. The inspection performed that catches that is a fracture critical inspection.
So it's a fracture critical component of the bridge. So one member in itself failing could collapse.
Correct. Okay. Yeah. So I think that that's important, and it was inspected, how it was missed. It's something that should have been caught, and typically in a fracture critical inspection, you've got to inspect every inch of that bridge within 3 feet. So that's one of the federal requirements.
3 feet of distance away from?
An arm's length, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, that's interesting. So there is a federal criteria that says on a fracture critical bridge or element of a bridge. It could be because we have really unique designs out there.
Yeah.
That you're actually inspection should, you should be within 3 feet of that member.
Yeah. And that's why this bridge is getting a lot of attention because technically if you're within 3 feet of every member of this bridge, you would have seen.
That one's obvious.
Yeah. It's an obvious deficiency.
Because it was, in reading some of the information about the situation is that it was photographed, it was actually shown in a photograph from a kayaker well below the bridge, several, 100 feet below the structure or 50 feet or whatever the distance was.
Yeah.
And they could blow that up to the point that they could see that.
Yeah.
I think what's important for me is that we are relying on human beings. And when we rely on human beings, there's all kinds of things that can come into play. It could be I'm disgruntled. I'm angry. There's human things that come into play, right?
They just had a bad day. I mean,
yeah.
We are
susceptible to not doing our best some days because of whatever circumstance may be.
How important is infrastructure? You know, how important are these things to us? Infrastructure and things that affect life. You know, to me, we're in it. We all, as professional engineers, go, this is quite important. But is that understood?
Well, I think from a design standpoint, it's whether you're thinking about it, doing it, drawing it, or whatever it might be, and then constructing it, safety and the preservation of life is always number one. You're not going to do anything that's going to hurt someone else. You simply don't do that. And so whenever you're doing your job, we're out digging a hole, we always think, okay, is that safe? we're out putting a beam up or building a structure. Is it safe? You see it all the time. You see it being practiced all the time. And part of your challenge, of course, Ben, as you've done so well in telling us, is there's the hidden elements of bridge inspection and the results of whether it's fatigue, in this case, a crack in the I-40 bridge over the Mississippi. It's important that you're able to go ahead and sort of understand that and then bring it to the forefront. Like you've talked about, Scott, and being about making people aware of what's going on so we can actually allocate time and funds and the energy towards maintaining these structures.
I want to get a reaction from you both, because you may not have lived what I've been in, is this thing where you have a manager of a city or a county or state actually tell you, quit crying wolf about the infrastructure to the governing body. Don't bring this stuff up. You're not going to get the money. Quit bringing it up. What's your reaction to that?
I mean, unfortunately, I think that happens everywhere. And we deal with it a lot, where we as engineers have to decide, where is that line? It's our responsibility, and we know that it's probably not going to get the best attention, but it's our duty to inform them of the condition. And, we do the best we can. We get a window of preventative maintenance, but, uh-huh. And it's nice to see people starting to take advantage of that, but it's been a slow growth. I mean, it used to be they'd wait to the end of it and, they'd put us in a position of saying, listen, I've got to close this. Unfortunately, that's when you get attention. When you tell them,
that's exactly right.
And then it's almost too late, because it's like, well, now we have to do a major rehabilitation, mm-hmm. or we have to do a new bridge, and it costs a lot more money.
Yeah.
So.
No, I thank you. And it's really.
A park is more important than critical infrastructure maintenance.
Yeah. Yeah.
To the managers.
Yeah, because people see it, that people use it. There's a political body or even the engineering echelon and management in that at times thinks that there's more kudos coming out of, as you say, the park mowing,
yeah,
as opposed to the bridge that needs maintenance, so our community doesn't have to spend $5 million down the road to replace it versus $200,000 to really fix things up, and then that'll draw that $5 million need either into some other infrastructure, yeah, or well down the road. Back to your question, Scott. It's our duty to keep informing that, and sure, the ramifications, and we see it all the time, is when you're told to try and wolf, we want to say no. This is important. This is part of my job.
It's
part of my license as a professional engineer.
It's rough.
If I stamp something. Yeah.
That's a rough position.
It is.
So, 80%, I said earlier, 80% of our infrastructure you actually own in your own community.
Mm-hmm.
So I encourage you to go to the board meetings and ask these questions and give your engineering staff, your public works staff, your state engineer's office, your DOTs a little help,
yeah,
with the political body about,
yeah,
real conversations.
Because from a consulting or a public employee's standpoint, and Scott, you've lived this a lot more than I have, it's wonderful to see the public participate in this work.
Yeah.
Ben, you'll see that. And if you have the opportunity, which you will obviously or have or do, present to DOTs and public meeting,
yep,
issues, especially major cases like this bridge in, mm-hmm, Arkansas, is that you relish the opportunity, and you always welcome people's comments. No, mm-hmm, question is a dumb question from the public asking about, mm-hmm, about a project, an engineering project, because we, yeah, want to help you understand things. So it's the understanding. We're not here to push stuff down your throat to so-called educate. We're here to give you information so you understand what
Thank
we do.
You, Murray. Yes, exactly.
Well, and that helps with, it's like we were talking about earlier about awareness, parks, they get more attention, but I think if the public understood what it costs for a bridge and to repair a bridge, they would have no problem putting the money to where it needs to go to be safe first. Because like you said, that's an innate thing. We want to protect and be safe. And if everybody really understood that, well, frankly, like you said, stopped hiding it, I think it would be easier to push things through, like the transportation bill. Like, yes, those people wouldn't fight it as much because they would realize it's needed.
Yeah. And you're paying
and
them
job creation.
Yeah.
you're paying the taxes, you're paying the mill levies, whatever it is, you're still paying them, irregardless of where the money goes. So if you see the need for critical elements of your infrastructure, then be a proponent of that.
It comes back anyway. Those tax dollars come back in your community anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're seeing a little bit here in the metro area about what CDOT's doing, the Colorado Department of Transportation, is most of their highways now involve express lanes. And the reason for express lanes is they only have so much budget. So they're only going to be so wide, and those express lanes are a way of recouping those funds because there's been some major obstructions to taxations, gas tax, fuel tax, this type of thing, over the last 30 years in the state. So they have to go ahead and recuperate those funds. It's not just a bottomless pit of money at CDOT.
It's far from it.
Yeah.
It's a big shortfall.
A huge shortfall.
In all states.
And one way is to go ahead, and it's painful. I know a lot of people think, I don't like express lanes. But if you have two lanes, sometimes you have to pay for them.
Yeah.
There's no other way. And bridges are no different. You know, they're part of that whole new way of providing transportation.
Yeah. Ben, are you up for talking about something fun?
Sure.
You've got a colleague here too.
Yeah.
Things Ben does and his team does is just badass scary to me.
It's crazy, crazy.
It's just the underwater thing and the hanging from bridges thing. I just want to hear a story or two from these two because I would never do it.
There's no way I would do it.
I would not do what these two are doing.
A little bit of rock climbing, some snow and ice and that. And I just had no wind to sort of come down and go home.
And going underwater in a muddy river in the Midwest. And I'll let you two think of a story and both of you can tell one.
Okay. Well, I've got it. Well, I've got one.
All right.
I think so. Remy's a Sprat, a rope access engineer, and I'm a dive engineer. But I've spent a good portion of my career and I've dove in bridges kind of across the country. And I was, you know, people always say here when we're diving in Colorado, I can't believe you get in. And Colorado is a great place to dive. It's clear, it's a little bit cold. But there's nothing in there that can bite you.
that 12-inch trout ain't too bad.
Yeah, it's not that bad. I'll be cold any day. Now, if you're diving in Florida and you're in a pipe, I mean, there was one time I was going through a pipe. It was maybe 2 foot diameter. And I barely could fit my tank. And I was diving surface supply. And that means that I have air coming from the top.
Okay.
I'm going down this pipe. And, you know, it's a little bit nerving. You're a little bit nervous kind of going through there because you can't see anything. It's black water. And you've got, you know, your flashlight and you're looking for collapsed pipe. I want to make sure there's no fill loss, sediment. So you have to make it all the way through. So I got to the end, toward the end, and the other side of it was gated off. And
The pipe was gated.
On the other side. So yeah, I was going into a pipe.
No way
was
out.
No
way out.
Yeah.
They didn't have a dead end sign.
No way out.
And you couldn't turn around.
I found out how. I didn't know how it was possible, but I turned around.
You were amazing.
Yeah, but I saw, so there was an alligator on that side, and it was scared. So it just was coming at me, you know, with a wake behind it.
It was in the pipe on your side of the gate?
It was between the gate and me as I was going down.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, I turned around.
Cornered this bad boy.
I did, without realizing it. Yeah. And I've never swam, crawled so fast in my life. I was out of that, yeah. So probably took me half an hour to get down there, and I was probably out in 3 or 4 minutes, you know. Yeah.
So you learned, you're what, 6'4"?
Yeah.
Learned to turn around in a 30-inch diameter pipe.
It was ridiculous. But
with a diving bell on.
With a diving hat, big diving hat.
Oh, my God. And you get down underneath the big river. What do you do when you inspect a footing?
So, I mean, footings generally are pretty straightforward. You know, you're looking for undermining. You don't want it to, you're making sure the eccentricities are right. You know, that there's no undermining happening where the pier could shift. Most of the time their footings, the new bridges are caissons, they're drilled the shafts or they're piles under the footings. But a lot of the older bridges, you know, they would just set the footing right on the riverbed. Yeah. So it's pretty important to do a little research and know what you're looking at.
What we call scour.
Yeah, scour. We spend a little bit more time on those older bridges just making sure, because what happens is during like peak runoff season, you lose a lot of fill then it slows down and it infills. So to somebody who's not as trained, they may look at it and think it's fine, but really it's
loose.
It's very loose. It, you know, you could probe your probe rod.
How the heck do you do that down there? You're using your hands.
We have some different tools. I mean, a probe rod is my favorite tool when I'm diving, but you know, it really is experience. I mean, I can see it now. I know what it looks like when it's been infilled. And there's also certain characteristics of what infilling looks like and what eddies do to sediment.
I'm betting most of our audience doesn't realize there's actually people going down into those waters inspecting foundations. And how often does this have to happen?
So underwater inspections are every 60 months. And then routine inspections are every 2 years for every bridge. It's over 20 feet, major structure.
Wow, that's a lot.
So again, you know, these all go into the cost of infrastructure. So just continuing costs, yeah. And so lumping in repairing and preventative maintenance is just another cost that needs to happen to where we don't have to actually replace down the line.
So you're saying, Ben, is, you know, obviously you're looking at currents, eddies, you know, just an element of your stream flow around bridges. So some of it's just, like you said, incredibly soft. It has no support value. Because I've done a little bit of bridge scour analysis and it's sort of interesting.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And a bit, obviously that's why you put riprap, you put rocks and stuff around the piers and so you don't undermine them to the point that it becomes unstable. And so you've probably seen some that have been quite unstable or.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've done a lot of, you know, that's what I specialize in. So we do a lot of that inspection. We'll do designs to repair that. And like you said, scour analysis. And scour analysis, you know, without going too off the cuff, you know, it's very theoretical still.
It is.
You know, so we go and take core samples and we base everything on that sample.
Are you bringing that back now so they can do more empirical data comparison to an analytical analysis and to what's actually happened so they can get some sort of empirical adjustments to analysis so it's more realistic or not?
No, I mean, they have, so what supports scour analysis is the HEC manuals. That's a hydraulic engineering circulars. Yeah. And those are...
Corps of Engineers.
They've done some, come up with some basic calculations to where, you know, it's got grain size and depth of water, velocity that kind of go into checking that. But like you said, it's at the very early stages of engineering in this area. So, you know, we go out there and we take a core sample in one area and we base literally our whole scour analysis off of that and FEMA maps. And even the FEMA maps are changing all the time.
Oh yeah, your floodplain. Yeah.
Floodplains change. Yeah. Yes. I mean, it's still that we're doing the best we can with what we have. And then even then, a lot of times, you know, we still will get scour depths that just don't really make sense based on those. So we've got to use we've got to use some engineering judgment in there to be realistic on, because like you said, there's only so much money. Do you spend it on a scour countermeasure on a bridge that has a history of not showing scour, even though our math shows that it scours? Do you fix that or repair that? Or do you fix the joints that are falling apart and you can see them falling apart? So those are the decisions, you know, that are we make every day.
Well, we need to hear about a climbing story.
introduce your colleague.
So this is Remy Stern. Remy does a lot of the analysis for us. He's been doing the C-70 tunnel project. So he's been managing that for engineering operations. The tunnel is the large infrastructure going through Denver right now. They actually just put traffic through it.
Yep, starting Monday. Monday.
Be that far along?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. There's bidirectional traffic in the North Bore right now.
Big underground highway.
And the viaduct is under demolition right now. So there are...
Oh, I did not know.
That's a dig and cover, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a cut and cover.
Cut and cover.
Yeah, so they have... Not sure exactly how long the cut is, but it's quite a long ways between Brighton and Colorado where they've dug underground 30, 40 feet, replaced it with a bunch of different structures that go over and carry city streets over I-70, and then 1,000-foot tunnel there as well. Whoa. So they're halfway done now.
Yeah.
But it's open.
My other favorite topic is lack of urban planning and reserving right-of-way.
Well, it's cool what they're doing on this project too, because I think you guys mentioned parks as well. On top of the cover, they're actually giving the elementary school in that area back some open space, soccer fields, amphitheater.
That was taken from them.
That was taken from them when the highway was built. So it's cool they're kind of giving back to the community as well as, you know, refreshing the infrastructure. Yeah, I'm not sure if I really have a good climbing story. I don't have.
What does a climbing story mean?
Just about it.
What do you do?
So
people don't know.
Rope access is how you access these fracture critical bridges a lot. Since you have to be within 3 feet of the member, you need to figure out a way to access them. So whether it be with a snooper truck, which is a truck that drives on the structure and can actually swing come underside, so you can access from the bucket there, going up in a bucket truck, or accessing via rope access. So that's how you would access these fracture critical members, typically where you have large spans and there's really no other way to get underneath there. So
rope access is you hanging off the side of the bridge on a rope.
You got it. Whether
two ropes.
So there's
a backup. There's a safety.
So you got one safety rope and then one rope that you're actually actively climbing on that's holding your
tension. I hear the guys that are really good. You're probably really good. I'm just assuming you're really good. But they're like,
I'm definitely more novice.
I hate the two ropes. So what is this for? Or is it too much crap?
I know. I love the extra safety.
Do you like
that? I'm definitely afraid of heights, which is kind of weird. But as long as I'm clipped off, I think I'm okay. But if, you know, the chairlift scares me, stuff like that where you're not attached, I'm, you know, a little frightened. But when you're clipped off, I'm not really thinking about falling. So,
yeah. All right, gentlemen. What would you like to tell your general public about bridges? Parting notes.
I guess it would just be that, you know, there is a lot of cost that goes in with bridges and maintaining them. And that there's a whole team of people out there at the state levels, at consultant levels that are, you know, looking after protecting you. And it does cost money. And we're going to do it no matter what, the best we can. We're going to work with whatever we have, but there is a cost out there, and just to know that.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Thank you, gentlemen. Be careful out there. You guys are in it. All right. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bernie.
This podcast is in part of a foundation for open conversation regarding the A&E industry. In future episodes, we'll discuss the realities of the industry today and what the future may look like. It is our belief that positive changes for architects and engineers is not the obligation of the industry, but rather your choice to reimagine how we work together. We invite you to join us in creating a world in which design professionals thrive. Get involved by joining our email newsletter, where you'll get information not found anywhere else. Go to leveldesignpartners.com to sign up. If you found value in this episode, support us by sharing it with someone or leaving a review. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and we'll talk to you next time.